This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we're hosting Eric Person. He's here to speak with us about the KC Growers and their efforts with Cultivate KC to get to the Black Urban Growers Conference in Oakland, California. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your headline news. EcoWatch.com reports, NextGen Climate released polling showing that young voters in key presidential swing states are looking for a presidential candidate with a plan to tackle climate change, strengthen our economy, create jobs, and improve public health by accelerating the transition to clean energy. In a poll of young voters in key battleground states conducted by Hart Research, 74% of voters under 35 said they would be more likely to vote for a presidential candidate who set a goal for powering America with 50% clean energy by 2030. A clear majority of these young voters, more than 80 million of whom are eligible to vote in 2016, say that this goal is necessary and an important priority for the country. Just 2 weeks before Pope Francis' visit to the United States, where he is expected to call for urgent action to protect the world's environment, 28 people, led by local members of the Catholic Worker Movement, formed human chains shortly after this morning across both entrances of Crestwood Midstream on Route 14. Joining the protest was famed peace activist Martha Hennessy, the granddaughter of Catholic Worker co-founder and candidate for sainthood Dorothy Day. This past Wednesday, blockaders held banners that said, "Pope Francis, we hear you," and "We are Seneca Lake, caring for our common home." Schuyler County deputies arrested 28 shortly before 7:30 a.m. as they read from the pontifical document. This blockade comes just 3 days after the Labor Day morning fire on Crestwood's lakeshore property sent smoke billowing over the lake, alarming local residents, boaters, and tourists. The fire started in a generator that services Crestwood's U.S. salt plant. Crestwood's methane gas storage expansion project was approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last October in the face of broad public opposition and unresolved questions about geological instabilities, fault lines, and possible salinization of Seneca Lake, which serves as a source of drinking water for 100,000 people. Yielding to pressure from campaigners across the state who spent years pushing the University of California to divest its holdings from fossil fuels, the university system's chief investment officer announced yesterday that $91 billion fund would begin by pulling all direct investments out of coal and tar sands mining companies. Those investments, totaling $200 million, have already been removed. The announcement came just days after the California state legislature voted to force the two largest pension funds in the U.S., the California Public Employees Retirement System and the California State Teachers Retirement System, to pull their combined $500 billion fund out of coal companies as well. Divestment activists welcomed the UC decision as an important first step resulting from years of campaign work by students and advocates, but pledged to keep working until administrators make a commitment to divest from all fossil fuels. The University of California is one of the largest university systems in the world, overseeing 10 campuses across the state. Its Board of Regents manages a system-wide fund of approximately $91 billion. By comparison, Harvard University's endowment stands at $33 billion. Organic Consumer Association reports a victory in the fight to save the bees. A United States appeals court ruled on Thursday that federal regulators erred in allowing an insecticide developed by Dow AgroSciences onto the market, canceling its approval and giving environmentalists a major victory. And finally, the Coalition in Independence, Missouri, Help Us Save the Woods, the Animals, and the Neighborhoods, has some positive news. The city council voted against them, forcing them to get 4,000 Independence registered voters' signatures in 3 weeks. And when our own Mike Murphy reached out to them today for an update, he was greeted with this recorded message.
Hi, this is Susan. If you're calling about saving the woods, well, we did it. The city will now have to either repeal the rezoning or put it up to the voters, either on the November ballot or a later one. There is a city council meeting on the 21st at 6 p.m. where they should be deciding this, and they need to see us. We need to be there. They need to know that we expect them to keep faith with the voters and the people of the neighborhoods that live around that forest. They need to be there. We need to show them that we are still watching. So I'm hoping I will see you on the 21st. And anybody else, if you need to leave a message, please do so, and I will call you back.
All right, and that was, we just got that earlier today, and we're really glad to hear that news. It's good to have some good news on this program. We quite often are sharing some of the daunting challenges, and so it's really good to hear about some victories. And that seems like a pretty daunting challenge for them. They had to get 4,000 signatures of registered voters in the city of Independence. And that's just a phenomenal effort. And like Natural E said, they had like a three-week window to do that. So hats off to them. That's incredible work on the ground. I know Susan and a lot of her team were, that's what they pretty much devoted themselves to for these the past month or so. And yeah, it's pretty impressive. So the city council meeting is a week from today. I didn't catch the time. Is it at 6 o'clock? Naturally, did you happen to catch it?
I didn't hear it.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to see what we can find out about that and get that to you. But it's a week from today that the city council is meeting. And as Susan said in her message, the city council has two choices. Either they can just right away, right off, abide by the wishes of the folks who got the 4,000 signatures, or they can have a referendum on the ballot, on the next ballot, and put it to a vote. And so they're looking to pack the city hall next Monday. And we will, if we don't announce it by the end of the program, we will get it up on Eco Radio's Facebook page. And all that happening a week from today. So again, good news and fair play to those folks. And now joining Natural E and myself in the studio is Eric Person. And welcome, Eric.
Hello, welcome. welcome. Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in. We appreciate it. So you're working on an effort to try and get some local folk here to a conference or a training thing in Oakland. Is that the plan? Or
I guess basically in a nutshell, what we've done is sort of at a last minute attempt, if you will, to get some support from Kansas City. We have started a crowdfunding page. I guess let me give you a little background of how this got started. So if you go to our crowdfunding page, what you're going to read is something that says something like this. Kansas City Black Urban Growers, or KC Bugs, is a new group of black and brown urban farmers and growers and gardeners who represent grassroots urban agriculture, mobilization, and commerce. Recently organized by Grown in Ivanhoe and Cultivate KC, this group consists of a wide age spectrum as well as experience level. So what this is, we've got some of the growers from Kansas City, Kansas. We've got a few growers from Kansas City, Missouri, and we came together. We heard about this conference that's going on in Oakland called the Black Urban Growers Conference.
So when is the conference?
The conference is in Oakland, and it's October 15th through the 19th.
Is this an annual event, or is this like a special one-shot deal? Or
I believe this is their fourth year, but it's actually their second year where it's been this big. I believe last year was on the East Coast, and this year it's on the West Coast. So I recently just learned about it, and it was something that my employer asked me if I wanted to attend, and then we kind of just kind of had some meetings and some brainstorming sessions on, you know, is this feasible to do? And then out of that, we kind of collectively had some ideas about where we wanted to go from there.
So what do you know about last year's conference?
I don't know much. Just from what I've read on the internet, what I've seen just from reading articles on their websites. But what I've learned about this conference is the things that the the sessions, the breakout sessions that they're having, really address some of the issues that I've just recently, in the past year, have become concerned about. I've been growing in Kansas City for about 15 to 20 years, but there seems to be a disconnect between black farmers and the rest of the Kansas City food growing community. So the Black Urban Growers Conference will, I'm hoping to go there to capture information on how people there have networked and created their own grassroots organizations to help growers of color come together and try to network to address issues that they have as far as growing food.
I want to hear a little bit about your growing experiences, but I want, but before we get to that, I want you to elaborate on the disconnect between eaters and black growers.
This conversation has come up. The biggest disconnection right now is food deserts. So recently, I was able to sit in. I was privileged to sit in a conversation that we had with Claire McCaskill, where we addressed some of the major players in Kansas City. Harvesters was there. The Kansas City Health Foundation was there. Of course, it was held at Grown in Ivanhoe. So the meeting was about addressing food policy issues and food deserts. And a couple of things that Claire McCaskill found to her surprise was, you know, like growers don't get taxes like big corporations do. So if you're growing food for your community, you're not going to get the same tax breaks that, say, Tyson or, a major farm would. And that was kind of a surprise to her, and she felt like she was sincere about that being a shock to her and wanting to change that. But here in Kansas City, it's a lot of people will say it's easier to get a bottle of ketchup than it is to get a tomato. Wow. So you don't have access to fresh produce in the neighborhoods where I feel that it's needed most. Whereas if you go to so recently I was at the beginning of the growth season, most of the farmers get together and they talk about the challenges that they face in Kansas City and growing, and the issues that we want to address this year. And this year, when they put up the map of the farmers market in Kansas City, I noticed that it was an L shape, and the L shape starts sort of in South Kansas City, if you will, sort of in the Brookside area. It goes through Waldo. There's a farmer's market on Truce, and then our market, I'm the farmer's market manager at Ivanhoe. Mm. And there's a river river market, farmer's market, and then there's a couple of markets over sort of in the Skerritt neighborhood or in, off of Independence, if you will.
Mm.
And other than that, if you go east, basically, of Truce or Paseo, there's no other farmer's market. And to look at that map, you can go to, if you Google Kansas City markets and you look at the map, you can see where there's not food markets where there's not farmers markets in Kansas City. And I feel that issue, it shouldn't be like that. It's, like I said, it's an L shape, and the neighborhoods that probably need things like the SNAP program, where they can utilize their EBT cards to double the amount of money that they spend. So if they bring $5 to our market, what we do is, in conjunction with the Beans and Greens program, we match their $5 with another $5, so that doubles their money, and they're able to use that to spend their money with our vendors.
That's great.
So yeah. Our vendors are people that live inside the neighborhood. Ideally, this is I work with Grown in Ivanhoe and the Kansas City Health Foundation to encourage growers inside and outside the neighborhood to grow food, come to our market, and sell their produce, and obviously make a profit. And it's a revitalization program. And ideally, we want to get people in Kansas City growing. And that's part of another disconnect, because Kansas City is probably one of the most they're really supportive as far as helping people that want to grow. People can grow on vacant lots. There's grant money available from the city where they will help you get water on the property to capture water, or you can meter water from a fire hydrant while you if you're growing on actively growing on land. And so with so many vacant lots and abandoned properties in Kansas City, you have the chance to get that community together and teach them how to grow, teach them how to harvest, teach them how to till the land and plant and when to plant. And then that you can create a community garden and let that community set up a farmer's market, say, on the corner. It's super easy. It costs $25 to get a business license in Kansas City, and then you can go from there.
So you mentioned, is it Greens and Beans?
Greens and Beans is a program, I believe, started by Cultivate Kansas City. They run it now, and it's been around for a while. I also run a aquaponic consulting business, and before that, I also had an indoor aquaponic farm, and we sold produce. And we were part of the Beans and Greens program, and that allowed us to capture some of the low-income residents in our neighborhood. But Beans and Greens, now taken over by Cultivate Kansas City, is a program that is utilized throughout all Kansas City. Most farmers markets in Kansas City have Beans and Greens.
So they provide the funding or all of the funding or part of the funding
they just match dollars to EBT and SNAP benefits.
So someone comes down with their EBT card,
mm-hmm.
and they spend $10, they really are, how do I say it? I guess they're getting $20 worth of produce for that.
Right.
And the 10 of, as far as what the farmer gets $10 from EBT and 10 from Greens and Beans?
No. So ideally, if you come in and you have that $10, the vendor is only going to charge you whatever the market price
right.
for their produce. So the benefit for the vendor is that people who normally wouldn't have access to this food are ideally, we do have shoppers from outside the neighborhood who support us, and we're really thankful for those customers. But we mostly target, we're trying to supply fruits and vegetables, more vegetables than fruit, for the neighborhood. And so when they come to us, they can spend their SNAP dollars without having to go outside the neighborhood, and we have that produce there for them. So the benefit for the vendor is that they're able to capture those dollars without having to it's a participation model, I guess, if you would say. They're making money because they grew inside of the neighborhood, and then they're selling to people
right.
who are inside the neighborhood.
Right.
And that dollar stays inside the neighborhood. So that's why it's revitalization, because ideally, instead of those dollars that someone has made or that is they're being supplemented, they're still keeping inside of that community. Where most of the black dollar gets spent 1% in our community.
Wow.
So most other communities, whether it be the Jewish community or the Asian community, the Latino community, I live on the west side. So I see it. I see how, I attend a lot of Mexican restaurants on the west side, and I gladly put my dollars inside of those. But I would also gladly put those dollars into a black-owned restaurant or a black-owned business so we can rebuild our community, because that's what's needed. So.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, that's great. So Grown in Ivanhoe, I'm assuming all the vendors grow in Ivanhoe. Is that a...
No, we actually have one of our vendors grows out in Greenwood, Missouri. That's my job as a farmer's market, to go and make sure that they're growing to the standards set by, like, the Casey Food Circle.
It's organic?
Organic and
wow.
chemical-free.
Or chemical-free, yeah.
Yes.
Nice.
We also have a young lady by the name of Jenna Wilkins who does a lot of stuff in Kansas City. I mean, she's absolutely amazing. She grows in Ivanhoe, but she also grows in I guess it's the Northeast neighborhood, and then I think she also has another plot somewhere. But she'll bring all of that stuff that she grows to our farmers market, and she also connects with a couple of other farmers who has, like, I think one guy has an orchard, so she's brought apples to I think last week she had 5 different kinds of apples, and those are all grown in Kansas City.
Wow.
So we also have another lady named Christine Williams, and she has a catering company, and she lives out in Independence, and that she grows in her backyard. And I've been to her, you know, I've checked out, certified, you know, legit, you know.
Yeah.
So, but she brings all of that produce to Ivanhoe. We have a cooler that was donated to us by the Kansas City Power and Light, and we had a ribbon cutting ceremony for that at the beginning of the season, and so that allows our vendors to bring their produce to the market, you know, the day before or, you know, earlier in the day, because, you know, these are people that also have jobs.
Mm.
So, you know, they're farming, you know, to add to their income, and so we want to make it convenient for them. And like I said, the guy who grows for us, who lives in Greenwood, and so he grows in his backyard, and he's actually trying to start a vineyard, and he wants to start growing. He's got some grapes that he started. So like I said, those are some of the people that we work with, but those are not necessarily all the people who are participating in the KC Bugs. But some of those people are people like Cheryl Harville. We have an older gentleman from Kansas City, Kansas. And all of these people grow just in different spots in Kansas City. So it's a collective. But the Kansas City Food Circle and the Kansas City Growers Community is a network, but that disconnect is, I think, has to do a lot with the digital divide.
Yeah.
So
digital divide meaning just for our listeners that might not be aware, meaning that not everyone has equal access to the internet, basically.
Or wants equal access. I've talked to some farmers who are just, you know, I've encouraged them, hey, you know, take a picture of your tomatoes and, you know, have your grandkids or what have you sign you up for Facebook and post it on there. And there's no desire to do that. So there's a sort of a disconnect in of an old school mentality. I've been doing it this way, and I'm going to keep doing this. But that's what we hope to learn how to, you know, engage and somehow connect that. We're also going to the conference to try to bring it here in 2017.
Bring the conference here?
Yes.
Oh, I was going to ask you. I was going to suggest, why don't you get them, bring it here? Well, you're ahead of the curve there. That's great. We're going to take our first break, and we'll be back with Eric Person and Natural E and myself discussing black farmers, black urban growers, and the conference in Oakland and what's going on here on the ground in Kansas City. We'll be back in a bit.
Supporting KKFI, The Pitches, Crafts, and Drafts. Are you crafty? The Pitch is now accepting applications for vendors at Crafts and Drafts on November 7th at the Uptown Shops. Crafts and Drafts will showcase over 100 local vendors in time to kick off the holiday season. A link to the application is available on the homepage of pitch.com through September 1st. Crafts and Drafts also features food trucks and over 25 beers from local breweries. For more info, pitch.com or call 816-561-6061.
On the next Radioactive Magazine, host Craig LeBeau interviews Richard Mabian, president of the Kansas City, Kansas branch of the NAACP and board member of the Kansas Sierra Club. Richard Mabian believes that these two organizations should work together to further the goals of both organizations. Tune in for a unique look on how the NAACP and the Sierra Club should combine their forces. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Dive into the ocean from your computer on this CurrentCast.
Cast.
Working with Google's Street View, experts developed a 360-degree camera system mounted on an underwater scooter to record images as never seen before. In a 5-year project, the world's coral reefs are being recorded to view the effects of climate change and other adverse pressures on these sensitive living organisms. Richard Vevers, project director of the Catlin SeaView Survey and founder of Underwater Earth.
We need this data to be available so people can see what is happening and then act accordingly.
Now virtually anyone can explore the coral reefs and whet their appetite for conservation. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
This is Naturally. Thank you for listening to Eco Radio on KKFI. You are welcome to join our conversation. You can call 816-931-5534 if you would like to. Again, that's 816-931-5534. And we're here with Eric Person, who's a part of the Kansas City Bugs. That's the Black Urban Growers. Now, Eric, why is it important to you for more folks in the Black community to become growers?
Oh, wow. That's great. We've always farmed, even, I mean, before, you know, African culture is farming, part of anybody's culture is farming. But as a Black grower, that is something that traditionally, I mean, my grandfather was a sharecropper, and he had a garden in his backyard. And beyond having a victory garden, that was just something that we had. I mean, it was just when you have, you see, my grandfather and my grandmother together had 11 kids, you know, and back in the 80s, when I can remember, I had about 32 cousins. And so that was just in the Kansas City area. And so I come from a big family. So when you when you're trying to feed a lot of kids, obviously you have to have a lot of food. And so I think naturally just growing food was something that just came as something that you just did. So I guess that's where I get my green thumb. I think it's important that we learn to be self-sufficient. The biggest thing is, you know, a lot of people talk about a food crisis, or they talk about even in a case where there's some sort of ecological breakdown. I think it's important that you know how to, you know, save seeds and be able to, you know, cultivate that seed and then plant that seed and grow it and make it so that you can harvest it, and then you know continue that cycle, you know, over and over again. And that's just something that I don't see a lot of in the Black community. And so I think I took it upon myself to try, I guess, to that's an issue that I know about, so I can help bring awareness and help people educate themselves.
Mm-hmm. So the Ivanhoe, what's it called that you're a part of?
I work for the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council, mm-hmm. which was basically rehabilitated by J.B. Nutter. The building that we're in used to be a fire station, and then it was a boxing school. And I am the farmer's market manager for the Ivanhoe Farmer's Market.
Where is the farmer's market?
So farmer's market is on Fridays from 5 to 7. Our last market is September 25th. But it's on Fridays from 5 to 7, and it's located at 3700 Woodland. So that's about two blocks south of 39th Street, and one block east. Let's see, no block. West of Paseo, or one block west of 71 Highway.
And the last Friday the market is open is the
September 25th. Mm-hmm.
And so you talked about the importance of getting the people educated about self-sufficiency through growing our own food. Does the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council offer services to teach people how to grow and also how to help people acquire lots to turn into the farms?
That's a great question. Ivanhoe, ideally, yes. I was hired as a farmer's market manager to help people that want to grow and learn how to grow. So I guess, I mean, I don't know if if Ivanhoe put that in my job duties, but if someone was to come to Ivanhoe and say, I want to learn how to plant, I want to learn how to grow, and I have a piece of land, I would help them, yes. Mm-hmm. Ivanhoe purchased a lot next to the center that they've turned into a garden where people can lease lots, where you have to sign up at the beginning of the year. You lease a lot, and I think it's very inexpensive to grow whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And then again, with the help of KC Master Gardeners, they also provide raised beds for some of our vendors on vacant lots, and they'll help them with they've been very, very helpful, like donating things like soil or hay or just as playing a supportive role. They were Jim Koch was growing heirloom tomatoes, and he donates them to Ivanhoe. He's a master gardener of KC Master Gardeners in connection with Missouri University. And what they do is he donates the tomatoes for us to sell, and then we keep the profit for Ivanhoe. We are a not-for-profit, so we keep that in the community. But we've had people like Dana McDaniels. I don't know if you know. She's kind of started a seed bank in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. She's volunteered to come and do a class for us on seed saving. We've had, again, like I said, Sherry Harville came and showed our vendors how to properly store their vegetables so that when they harvest them, they can keep them fresh until they're ready to go to market. For the most part, I've pretty much got a lot of support from anyone I've asked, just to say, hey, do you mind coming teaching us a class, or do you mind giving us some time? We have people through the Missouri University Extension come and give mm-hmm. food classes on not really a class, but they'll come to the market, they'll get produce from the vendors, and then they'll show anyone visiting the market how to use those items to make a dish. So mm-hmm. that way people who are in the neighborhood can learn how to cook, you know, squash or zucchini or what have you. That way, a lot of times when you kids in the urban core don't know where their vegetables come from, I was able to help Grandview High School set up an aquaponics system in their biology class a couple of years ago, and the teacher was just amazed at the fact that they planted, you know, just herbs and lettuce and kale and what have you, and the kids would eat the basil and say, you know, wow, this tastes like pizza, and you know, to make that connection and to understand where that flavor comes from and that you can grow it. And not only that, some of the produce that they were growing, the kids were taking that home, and so they know he learned that the kids were probably supplementing some of the food that they weren't getting at home, you know, for the vegetables that they were growing at the school. But they also had to learn how to cook them, so that was another educational piece. And the kids, once they I also do aquaponic presentations at schools, and they want to learn. They want to if you're having a problem getting your kids eating vegetables, show them how to grow it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost that easy.
So do you teach the hydroponics in schools through the Ivanhoe or through your own?
Aquaponics.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm
sorry. Good. So the difference between aquaponics and hydroponics is they both are, you're growing vegetables in water. The difference is that hydroponics, you use a chemical solution. You can do hydroponics organically, but that chemical solution is usually the most expensive.
Uh-huh.
So for someone who's trying to learn sustainability, you want to go the least inexpensive route. Aquaponics is using fish waste or aquaculture. You can use some people use crawfish or other cold-blooded water bodies, animals, and you use the waste from those animals, and you pump that to a bed, usually containing a medium or substrate that allows the ammonia to settle in that medium. The nitrates turn into nitrogen through a chemical reaction from the bacteria kind of sitting in the air, if you will. And then that kind of takes the ammonia out of the water. The plants take some of the, they take out that nitrogen, and they return the water with some of the ammonia taken out, and that returns the water to the fish. And so it's a closed-loop system, and you're using that to grow your vegetables. And
do you do that through the Ivanhood Neighborhood Council or on your
own?
No,
I do that on my own.
Okay. And do you still do that?
I do. Okay. I do private consultations for people that want to build small systems in their house, kind of.
Now, is the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council on Facebook?
Yes. Grown in Ivanhoe is on there.
Grown in Ivanhoe.
And then Ivanhoe, the Ivanhoe Farmers Market.
And what are you going to do to prepare for and during the winter, since it's coming up?
Oh, well, that's that you ask. That's the wonderful thing about aquaponics is that you can do it year-round. So I'm currently rebuilding a system that utilizes high fluorescent lights and a small I use goldfish and I use a barrel it's basically a cement mixing barrel. So it's about 2 feet by 3 feet. It's about a foot deep. And I fill that up with water and goldfish, and then I have a small $30 pump that I pump to a 4 foot by 4 foot, and it's about a 6-inch bed, and I fill that up, and I'm going to grow some peas and some cucumbers through the winter, and some lettuce. But on a bigger scale, you can do bigger things, obviously. But I also save seeds. You know, right now is a time since fall is coming, just where you get things like the rest of the tomatoes that are, you know, on the vines, and the ones that are rotting, some of the rotting fruit that you see on the ground, and you collect those things. And there's a certain process that you have to do to seeds to save them. So that's really what we're focusing on right now, is a seed saving, because seeds are expensive. You have problems with genetically modified crops, mm-hmm. and getting seeds. So teaching seed saving is something that is also a part of just being self-sustaining.
Interesting. If anyone wants to join in on the conversation, the number is 816-931-5534. I'm wondering if you could tell us again about this conference in Oakland and what your efforts are to get people there, and like, who are you trying to get there? How many people?
So right now it's still up in the air. There's about 10 to 12 people, both from Kansas City, Kansas. We have a couple of workers from the Juniper Gardens in Kansas City, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And then we have a couple of workers, just different, a couple of people who I've known. And this is what's kind of odd about the dynamic about this, is because I've known some of these people, but I've never sat down at the table with them and talked to them about, hey, what do you do?
Right.
Gentleman, we're planning to go into the conference with. We've hooked up. He does aquaponics. He teaches kids aquaponics in school.
Wow!
And he's actually got some funding coming to build a high tunnel aquaponic greenhouse. It's a great project.
Wow!
You know, and that's going to be teaching kids how to do aquaponics. And you know, he when we were talking, he was like, "Hey, I might have a salary position kind of thing," and I was just like, "I might be talking to you about that." So, and this is the conversations that we need to have more,
right?
Because those conversations already happen in other communities, and it's not just our community though. There's a lot of disconnect. I mean, we have Native American farmers, we have Latino farmers, we have some refugee farmers over in Kansas City, and none of those groups are cohesive. None of those groups come together as people of color, if you will, and network, where I see that in other communities, a lot of networking and a lot of, you know, hey, I'm going to grow this produce for you, and I'm going to sell strictly for you. What do you want me to grow for you? So we need to have that cohesiveness. You know, there's no reason that I don't know what Nishi pays for her greens, but there's no reason that she shouldn't be getting from Kansas City during the summer. So, I mean, places right. like that, you know, if we have, you know, businesses in Kansas City that are providing, you know, food that can be grown here, then we should actively have that. So I'm hoping to capture that. I know that happens here, but I'm hoping to connect other farmers with how to make that happen here.
I got a question for you, Eric. What do you hope to accomplish, or what do you hope to learn at this conference in Oakland?
Again, it's still how they connect with each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, being in such a big city, The first day of the conference, there's a farm tour with several different stops at different farms. So it's going to be really interesting to see how in Oakland, with that being a port city, how they manage to grow in urban areas. That's.
And you said last year this event was on the East Coast?
From what I understand. Uh-huh. I'm not 100% sure. So.
But now it's on the West Coast, and you're hoping to bring it here the next year?
Yes. So some of the conversations that we have are, you know, how can we bring this here to – because again, the support for people that grow in Kansas City is really, really good. And in a lot of places, there's things like water restrictions where you can't capture water, you can't have rain barrels, you can't just grow in a vacant lot, you know. So a lot of cities and states are really restrictive. And Kansas City's, you know, they're really, really, I mean, we have a movement here. When they started last year, they said that I believe there were about 60 growers in Kansas City, and then last year there were 250 new growers.
Wow!
So it just exploded because there's just so much support, and then having a garden in your front yard, and people want more control of what they're putting in their body, so that really encourages. That really encourages people to want to grow their own food. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, food deserts, when you don't have that knowledge, you don't have that support, so you just continue to eat Cheetos and Takis, you know, or Flaming Hot Doritos, you know.
Yeah.
And you never get the nutrition that you need. You get the calorie intake, but there's no nutritional value. So I'm hoping to learn how they address those issues and how to engage more children as well as more community and more people, because along with getting the excitement about learning how to grow vegetables, you also get that, ooh, worms, bugs. So just engaging, you know.
Or I'm not going to eat that. That came out of the dirt.
Right, right, right.
Well.
Yeah. We're going to take our second break. But we still have time for if anyone wants to join in on the conversation, 816-931-5534. We'll be back in a moment.
You're invited to the 23rd annual UN Plaza Art Fair, the weekend of September 19th and 20th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church grounds. Affordable art, food, fun, and children's art activities. Support peace activism and local artists. For more information, go to peaceworkskc.org. That's the UN Plaza Art Fair. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Missed last week's Echo Radio KC? No worries. You can listen online at kkfi.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. This past June, Pope Francis published an encyclical calling for action on climate change, an issue he says has grave implications. Pope Francis argues that God, his creation, and humanity are interconnected, and emphasizes the moral and ethical dimensions of climate change. Dan Misla, executive director of the Catholic Climate Covenant, says the Pope's plea for action has not fallen on deaf ears.
Archbishop Supich in Chicago announced that he's going to work with the Environmental Protection Agency to measure the energy use of all 2,700 archdiocesan buildings. So that's an enormous commitment. And I think it demonstrates the willingness of the bishops to not only hear the message of the Pope, but to also act on it.
But the Pope's outreach is not limited to Catholics. When he addresses the U.S. Congress and U.N. General Assembly this September, he's expected to encourage the U.S. and the world to sign a global treaty during their upcoming climate change conference in Paris later this year.
His moral authority is pretty much unquestioned, so I think he's going to be calling the world and the negotiators in Paris to remember that these environmental questions are enormously important and that they have moral consequences.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Anyway, we're back here in the studio. I do want our listeners to know, if you find this conversation of interest, tune into Radioactive Magazine tomorrow night as a couple of our Eco Radio colleagues are on the air. Craig Lubo will be interviewing Richard Mabian. Richard is the president of the Wyandotte County NAACP, and he's also on the board of directors of the Kansas Sierra Club. And he will be talking about how to dovetail, I guess, those two organizations, get the NAACP more environmentally conscious and get the Sierra Club more socially justice and environmental justice conscious. That's on Radioactive Magazine tomorrow night at 6 p.m. And we've just got a few minutes left here. So I know we want to get out your website. Eric, what else did we need to mention?
Well, you can find a link to the website on our Eco Radio Facebook page. And what's the website a link to, Eric?
It's crowdrise.com, the Kansas City Black Urban Fundraiser / Casey Bugs. And the link will take you to, we're trying to raise, it's going to cost us about $14,000 to get to Oakland. And we have very little time. Like I said, this was kind of a last minute sort of, do we want to do this? And let's see how many people we can get together to try to go to this thing. Ideally, I think Ivanhoe was going to try to send me and another vendor just to go. And then we were kind of like, well, let's see who else wants to go. And so it kind of took off from there. And so we're trying to raise money. We have some incentives coming. We've got some donations from places like the Bluebird food restaurant. We've the Westside Local, Anton's, a couple of those places have donated some gift certificates, and we're also getting some incentives from other people we're also getting some donations from other people to give as incentives for donations, and we haven't really figured that out yet because of the CrowdRise site that we're using is kind of geared for nonprofits,
right.
And so it really didn't give us an option, if you will, to allow for incentives. So we're going to have to create that separately. But we're trying to just raise money to send. It's the conference, I believe itself, is about $300, and then the hotel and airfare is what we're trying to cover.
Mm. And when is the conference?
The conference is from the 16th through the 18th. So I said 15th to the 19th, but that's when we leave and come back.
Right, of October.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Anything else we need to make sure that we haven't touched on, or we need to?
No, support your local farmer. That's the biggest thing. The more you support them, the more they will grow. And that's all over Kansas City. I get all of plug here. I get all my beef downtown from Anton's. I know where it comes from. You know, they have a butcher shop in their restaurant. They get about four to eight cows a week. It's literally touched by four people, you know, so, it's minimally processed. They do a great thing with working with farms. You know, he's a green restaurant. He's taught me a lot, so I thought I at least have to give him a little plug, because he's really, really eco-conscious when it comes to, you know, they take about 4 pounds of trash out of the restaurant because they recycle all the glass and paper products. The water goes through the building and captures the 55-degree temperature of the earth, so it either heats or cools the building. It's a really, really great operation, and I helped him take care of his aquaponics too there, so... I want you to know about that. But yeah, support your local farmer, support your local grower, and if you see me out, say hey. I love Kansas City.
So thank you so much for coming in, and thanks for sharing this, and good luck with all your endeavors.
You.
It sounds like you're really fighting the good fight and trying to make our city a much better place and our planet a much better place, which is what this program is all about. So we really appreciate you coming in.
Green's not new to me. I've been part of the Sierra Club for about 15 years too, and I am a registered Green Party member. So,
all right. Okay, so I think we'll at this point go to the calendar of events. Are we ready to do that naturally?
I'm ready, Mike.
All right.
On Sunday the 20th at 1:15 p.m., join Peaceworks of Mid-Missouri on their Walk for Climate. This takes place at the Boone County Courthouse Plaza on 8th and Walnut in Columbia, Missouri. Help focus attention on the urgent need for climate action by joining in a 5K Walk for the Climate organized by Peaceworks with co-sponsorship of the Mizzou Energy Action Coalition, Renew Missouri, and Osage Group Sierra Club. Time to take place just prior to Pope Francis's address to Congress. We will gather and then walk as a group through downtown Como and the MU campus carrying signs and banners. You can find more information about this event on our Eco Radio Facebook page. Johnson County, Kansas is hosting another household chemical and paint recycling event on October 10th. Find more information about this event and schedule your drop-off by clicking the link on our Eco Radio Facebook page. Communicating about climate with faith groups with George Marshall. A pre-recorded webinar led by George, followed by a time of discussion with attendees. That's tonight, and it starts in 10 minutes. It goes till 9 o'clock at Village Church, which is located at 6641 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. How do you speak with faith communities about climate change and not totally turn them off? To learn how, Green Faith's Our Voices campaign teamed up with climate change communications expert George Marshall, founder of the Climate Outreach and Information Network, and author of Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, to interview international audiences of Buddhists, Hindus, Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Some very interesting and insightful conclusions were reached from these conversations. Again, that is starts at 7 till 9 p.m. at the Village Church in Prairie Village on 6641 Mission Road. The Missouri Recycling Association Recycling Conference is September 14th through 16th, this Monday through Wednesday, at Adams Point Conference Center, located at 1400 Northeast Coronado Drive in Blue Springs, Missouri. The 18th Annual Recycling Conference hosted by the Missouri Recycling Association will be held September 14th through 16th in Blue Springs. The event will feature site tours, recycling and composting exhibitors, a keynote address by Tom Zaki, the CEO and founder of TerraCycle, and featured speakers Elizabeth Klein, author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion, Christopher Ladd, the director and CFO of the Closed Loop Fund, Brandon Hamilton, the director of facilities for the Kansas City Chiefs, and City of Blue Springs Mayor Carson Ross. The conference will begin with a free welcoming reception open to the public 4:30 to 6 p.m. September 14th for anyone interested in talking with exhibitors and folks working in the recycling and composting industries. For more information and to register, visit moraconference.org. There's an electric vehicle car show September 16th, this Wednesday from 4:30 to 8 p.m. at Village Presbyterian Church, again at 6641 Mission Road. Electric vehicles will be available to view along the east side of the south parking lot. Owners will answer questions and show the many great features of their electric vehicles. No Holds Barred, Art, Dialogue, and Action on Climate Change. Friday, September 25th, 6 p.m. at the Uptown Arts Bar, which is located at 3611 Broadway. The second in a series in collaboration with the Sierra Club by the Uptown Arts Bar. At the time of the apostolic journey of Pope Francis to the USA, join us to learn more about the Pope's encyclical letter Laudato Si, On the Care of Our Common Home, which is his call to dialogue and action on the climate crisis. Expert panelists on the encyclical and the state of the climate change in the world discussion to follow. And there will also be music by the extraordinary duo Solar to follow. There's a champagne toast to Pope Francis, compliments of the Arts Bar. And Fridays from 5 to 7 p.m. Is when you can attend the farmer's market at the Ivanhoe neighborhood. And their last market will be on September 25th. And what's the location on that, Eric?
3700 Woodland,
Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. And that is my last event.
I do just want to mention, you mentioned the band Solar. One half of that duo, Craig Wolf, is going to be performing live on my program Wednesday morning. So he'll be playing live music right here on the air from 7 to 7:30 Wednesday morning. And We're going to go out as we like to with This Week in Water, and thanks to Eric and thanks to Natural E.
Thank you.
Floods in Japan sweep away radioactive waste. That and other stories for the week ending September 13th, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
At least five people were killed, and more than a dozen are still missing because of heavy flooding in Japan last week. The pounding rains forced the evacuation of almost 3 million people.
The strongest rain fell in storms north and east of Tokyo and caused rainwater containing radioactive material to be released into the ocean from the disabled Fukushima nuclear power plant.
Additionally, bags filled with grass and soil from work to remove radioactive substances from Fukushima were swept away by flooded rivers.
Climate change might have been a factor in the heavy precipitation. Ocean temperatures around Japan have been rising in recent years, producing vapor and making air conditions unstable, ideal for storms to incubate. Chinese scientists have discovered that an immense amount of water exists underneath a desert in a remote northwestern region of their country.
The size of the discovery is stunning. The large amount of water in this underground sea is estimated to be about 10 times the quantity of the Great Lakes of North America.
While the water quality is way too salty for drinking, the massive aquifer stores carbon and stops it from being released into the atmosphere.
Researchers were studying the role the world's deserts play in soaking up and storing carbon emissions from human activity when they found the desert ocean.
One of the Chinese scientists told Discovery News that the aquifer is like a can of Coke. If it were somehow opened, all the greenhouse gas would escape into the atmosphere.
All of the Earth's oceans absorb carbon, which keeps it out of the atmosphere. But too much carbon in the oceans is causing acidification and leads to the destruction of vulnerable food chains.
26 years ago, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker struck a reef and spilled a massive amount of crude oil into Alaskan coastal waters.
About 4 years after the spill, the local fishing industry that caught herring collapsed. And while it may seem obvious why that occurred, there was a lot of controversy over the role oil played in the decline.
Last week, a study was published in the journal Scientific Report that analyzed the long-term effects on fish from ingesting small quantities of oil.
Both salmon and herring, exposed as embryos to trace levels of crude oil, grew into juveniles with abnormal hearts and reduced cardiorespiratory function. The bottom line, the fish swim slower and are more vulnerable to predators.
Scientific confirmation of the effects of spilled oil on fish health is critical now as Shell is conducting exploratory drilling in the Alaskan Arctic, where the U.S. government has said the chance of a disaster is 75%. The Salton Sea has seen better days. At 350 square miles, California's largest lake was once a playground for Hollywood stars and was a popular destination for fishing and boating.
But now it's shrinking, stark, and largely abandoned. Agricultural runoff that feeds the lake has declined, and more troubles loom. First, in 2017, an agreement to transfer water to San Diego will reduce flows. And second, prolonged droughts due to climate change are expected to only exacerbate the situation.
And that stinks, literally. As the waters recede, the lake becomes saltier and saltier, leading to fish die-offs. Those decaying fish, along with leaves and other organic matter, emit noxious bubbles of hydrogen sulfide gas.
The gas resembles the smell of rotten eggs, and residents link it to increased asthma attacks and respiratory problems. Last week, gas levels were more than six times the state standard, setting an all-time record. An unfortunate milestone for a lake that many consider a vital habitat for birds and fish.
But help could be on the way. 2 weeks ago, Governor Jerry Brown filled a newly created position to oversee restoration of the lake. But fully restoring the sea to its original size isn't likely to happen. The most popular plan aims to maintain a smaller but sustainable Salton Sea, ringed by wildlife habitats and renewable energy projects.
A more manageable lake will hopefully tamp down comparisons to Owens Lake, which had its water siphoned off by Los Angeles in the early 20th century and went on to become the largest source of dust pollution in the entire country.
And finally this week, speaking of strong scents, perhaps you vacationed in Paris this summer. Home to art, fashion, good food, and culture, its picturesque cityscape is crisscrossed by wide boulevards, the River Seine, and
the most amazing sewer system ever. Surely your visit to the City of Light included a stop at this top tourist attraction? The labyrinth of tunnels beneath the Paris streets is a must-see for anyone interested in engineering and public works, and for fans of Victor Hugo's Les Misérables and the musical that it inspired.
During Hugo's time, the system was 360 miles long and had iron pipes for drinking water and sewage. It became such a tourist draw that mechanized cars were added to carry well-heeled Parisians throughout the vaulted channels whilst they reclined at tables in their finery.
Perhaps it was the growing popularity of the sewers that inspired Hugo to incorporate them into his novel. He saw the sewers as the conscience of the city, a place where class distinctions disappeared. But he also saw the system as a frustrating missed opportunity to use the sewage as fertilizer.
If you do go, don't forget to stop at the gift shop where you can pick up a sewer.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.